previously on Beta.
RAM is the fastest available storage, but it's not permanent. It's called volatile, which means it's limited. But the packaging provides a nice plastic tapping sound.
All Satan can do is gum us because his fangs have been removed.
This is going to sound a little crazy. None of this is happening. This is all a holographic simulation.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Oscar and Grammy-winning producer and musician T-Bone Burnett discusses his first album in 11 years. It's called The Invisible Light, Acoustic Space.
The thing about visual space is the space of the predator. You know, we look for the thing we want to eat, whereas acoustic space, audio space, is the space of the prey.
And journalist Clive Thompson on how there's no gray area when it comes to coding.
You can't come to me and tell me that code isn't working. It is. It is a machine. It is doing what I wanted it to do. So there's this sense of crisp clarity in the winds of coding.
But first, Penny Lane. She's an indie filmmaker who makes provocative and funny documentaries that explore big ideas. Her latest is called Hail Satan? The doc is about a group that calls itself the Satanic Temple, but doesn't actually believe in the existence of Satan.
Modern Satanists are essentially atheists at their core. They don't believe in spirits in the sky or demons underground. They do believe in the power of myth and allegory and art and ritual. Those are things that we associate with religion that the Satanic Temple and Satanists want to keep. The Satanic Temple wants to start from a position of acknowledging the essential kind of mythological function of religion. So they want to participate in a now 2,000-year-plus cultural conversation we've been having that Christianity gave us. These stories that we're all familiar with from the Garden of Eden right on. And they want to suggest that perhaps Satan is not the bad guy, but perhaps Satan is the good guy, because Satan stands up to this authoritarian figure, God, and questions these kind of edicts that come from above. Satan doesn't fall in line. Satan kind of wants man, wants humankind to seek knowledge and to look to themselves for guidance, not to sort of authoritarian, tyrannical, invisible beings.
Yeah, rather than a religion, it almost comes across more like a philosophical, life-affirming approach to encourage people to take action and to change things for the better themselves. Would that be fair to say?
I think that's absolutely fair to say. And, you know, many people in the West question whether Buddhism is a religion or if it's more of a philosophy, because most sects in Buddhism don't organize themselves around a divine being. It's actually sort of an atheistic point of view about sort of how to best live in the world. So it doesn't really matter to me if people think that Satanism is a religion or it's a philosophy. Either way, it's a very interesting worldview that I wanted to capture in this film.
Mm-hmm. And there are many funny moments in the film, and one of them occurs in the opening scene outside the Florida State Capitol in Tallahassee. Can you tell me about this scene?
Yeah, it's really the origin story of the Satanic Temple, which is somewhat mind-blowing. The story goes that something like three people in 2013 heard that then-Governor Rick Scott had been pushing for a new bill that would allow prayer in public schools. And, of course, Rick Scott didn't really think that anyone would use that new opportunity other than Christians. So the Satanists showed up and said, well, us too. You know, if you're going to allow prayer in public schools, we support that, but only if you are going to allow all religions to equally take part in that opportunity. So it was kind of meant as a satirical kind of stress test to the First Amendment. We say in the First Amendment the government can't privilege one religion over another.
It's a beautiful day here at the state capitol. Great day to be a Satanist. Great day to be a human being. We honor Governor Rick Scott. Hail Satan, Rick, for providing us this opportunity to make the satanic cause clear
and make our presence known. And I believe it, and I'm very excited about it.
But within weeks or months of that event, which was very successful and kind of got a lot of media attention, people started showing up and saying, how do I join? So what you see in my film is kind of, how could it be that this really rather silly idea, meant as a political prank amongst a few friends in 2013, has blossomed into an internationally recognized religious movement with over 100,000 members.
One of the things that the Satanic Temple members are really good at is media manipulation. We talked about the Rick Scott rally already, but what else has the temple done in terms of media manipulation?
They know that if they pull certain kinds of pranks and use certain kinds of images, they're likely to end up on the nightly news. Probably the campaign the Satanic Temple is most well known for is their Baphomet campaign. So this is a case where in Oklahoma, a big monument to the Ten Commandments was put up. And the Satanic Temple, as they are wont to do, kind of showed up and said, great, now that you've opened up this statehouse lawn to religious monuments, we would like to place our religious monument next to the Ten Commandments. And the monument they designed was a 9.5-foot tall, kind of goat-headed, angel-winged, sort of partly male, partly female figure that incidentally has Iggy Pop's chest.
Here's a more recent picture of our monument. It stands at 8 feet 6 inches in height, a width at the base of the throne of 37.25 inches. From the back of the throne to the front, it's 46.5 inches. And the widest point is at the tips of the wings, which is 55.5 inches in width.
The Baphomet monument is far more than simply some middle finger to the evangelical right. Really, we were giving the Oklahoma government a civics lesson.
It must be removed. That is the order on the Ten Commandments monument outside the state capitol in a 7-2 vote by the Oklahoma Supreme Court.
Well, a group of Satanists is tonight claiming victory. Are you still pushing to have the goat with the horns and so on put up on the state capitol grounds?
No, we don't want our monument there without the Ten Commandments there. The point all along was that it would complement and contrast the Ten Commandments and reaffirm that we live in a pluralistic nation that respects diversity and religious liberty.
Another one of the people you profile in your film is Jex Blackmore. Can you tell me a bit about Jex?
Jex was very involved in the Satanic Temple from the very beginning. She's based in Detroit. She's an incredible artist. She's an incredibly inspiring and charismatic person.
The devil appeared in the form of a snake and offers the fruit of enlightenment. We are taught to fear that, but at the same time, it seems the most liberating because if we did not have that opportunity, we would have to be in total servitude without free choice. And ultimate servitude is slavery. Reframing it in the light of it being salvation is probably one of the greatest tricks ever played on humankind.
She is no longer with the temple. The reason for her leaving the temple is covered in my film. And it essentially boils down to difference in tactics. Do you want to be the kind of Satanist who works within the system? Or do you want to be the kind of Satanist that wants to kind of rebel from a position outside the system? And you see that conflict play out in my film.
Satanism is about embracing that satanic status rather than being controlled by it.
Instead of the Ten Commandments, the Satanic Temple has the Seven Tenets. What are the Seven Tenets?
Well, the Seven Tenets are the kind of baseline doctrinal text of the Satanic Temple. The first one is one should act with compassion and empathy towards all creatures in accordance with reason. And I haven't memorized them all, but the Seven Tenets emphasize things such as the importance of aligning your beliefs with the best scientific evidence, the willingness to change your mind in the face of new information, the importance of standing up for what's right, the struggle for justice being an ongoing and necessary pursuit that is more important than laws and institutions in certain cases.
I'm curious about the members of the Satanic Temple. Who are they, and do they have anything in common?
That's such a good question. In some ways, the members of the Satanic Temple that I met are all completely different, but they do have some things in common. Well, the first thing is obvious. You have to be a certain kind of person to announce that you are a Satanist to the world. You know, you have to be okay with the fact that most people are going to misunderstand you. Most people are going to not like you.
Yeah.
Most people are going to be offended by your existence. Not a lot of people are willing to sort of occupy that position. So you have to kind of enjoy that on some level, you know? Another interesting level is that the people I met in the Satanic Temple are some of the most well-read people I've ever met. I mean, all of their kind of coming to Satanism stories tend to revolve around going to the bookstore or going to the library. It's a really interesting kind of thing for them all to have in common. They're really open-minded, curious, truth-seeking people.
I read in an interview that you said something to the effect that every one of these people have felt completely alone their whole lives and had never felt part of a group until they realized they could be part of this one.
That's right. It's really important to say that. And it's a religion for people who hate religion, and it's a religion for people who have felt persecuted or ostracized by the religions they grew up with.
Yeah. I've read that your role model is the anonymous British street artist Banksy, and that you're a big fan of his documentary Exit Through the Gift Shop. So how did Banksy and Exit Through the Gift Shop influence the way you approached making Hail Satan?
Such a good question. I think that I really want to make films that are about really big ideas, like the biggest, most important philosophical ideas of our time. But I want to do it in a way where nobody notices that's what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I really want my audience to just have fun and be entertained and laugh and feel joy in their heart and really only later realize the tremendous amount of intellectual labor they have just expended.
After Exit Through the Gift Shop came out in 2010, many reviewers questioned the authenticity of it and whether or not it was a hoax. That's such a big influence to you. It made me wonder, and I kind of wondered this anyway at various points in the film, is the Satanic Temple really a religion, or is it just a very, very elaborate prank?
Yeah, I'm totally open to the idea that people bring that skepticism to my film. I would hope that people would have that skepticism with every film, but unfortunately they don't. I definitely wondered that at the beginning of this project. There was I thought a good chance that I would get closer to the Satanic Temple and discover that it really was essentially a joke. That's not what I discovered, but I've seen some critics and reviewers say things like, I can't really tell if this is a mockumentary or a documentary. And I think that's great because, again, when you do films like that, you instill in your viewer a kind of critical awareness and skepticism that we should all have a little more of in our lives.
How did your personal understanding of religion evolve over the course of making Hail Satan?
My own personal relationship to religion underwent a complete transformation making this film. I think when I started the film, if I am honest, I really just didn't get religion at all. I had kind of towed the sort of new atheist dogmatic line that religion is just stupid. Like, why do people do this? Like, just seems so silly and confusing from the outside. I would have said that the world would be better off, or will be better off, once we get rid of all this stupid religion stuff. And that everyone should just be an individual and act as such and stop having this dumb group thing. I really did feel that way. And I do feel that way to some extent, you know. But making this film partly started out as a way of kind of making fun of religious people. And then I realized that I was making a film about religious people whom I admired very much and had nothing but respect for. So, you know, I started to understand how important religion is for people and for how they make meaning of their lives and how they find their tribe and learn how to express themselves and do good works in the world. You know, the kind of things you really can't do by yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, when was the last time by yourself you went and, like, picked up trash on the side of the highway? But, you know, if you join with your religious group, certain things are possible that you can't do alone.
Hail Satan premiered at Sundance, which, of course, is in Utah. So I'm wondering, how did people at that screening react to the film?
I love that question because, you know, I've been to Sundance a few times with films. And Usually you don't really notice that you're in Utah. The Utah-ness of Sundance is not usually so obvious, but you really notice you're in Utah when you're there with Hail Satan. It was a really great experience because most of the festival volunteers and a big part of the audience are people from Salt Lake City or just from local communities. They responded to the film with tremendous joy.
You mentioned the festival volunteers at the Sundance screening. I read somewhere about there was this one volunteer who was about in their 70s somewhere who told you at the beginning of the screening that she wasn't happy to have been assigned to your film.
Yeah, that's true. And then I was sort of awkward about it, like, okay, well, I don't really know how you respond to that, but I just sort of tried to smile and said, like, maybe you'll enjoy it more than you think you will. And then at the end of the screening, she ran across the lobby to talk to me, and she said, I think I might be a Satanist.
Penny Lane is the director of the documentary Hail Satan. You can find out more about Penny or the Dark Lord on our website, wpr.org/beta.
We've gone through over a century of electronic programming as a race, and it's led to a whole plethora of different problems, some of which are neurological, like Alzheimer's and autism and Asperger's.
Producer, musician, and songwriter T-Bone Burnett joins us to discuss his latest album. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Musician and producer Joseph Henry T-Bone Burnett is known for many things. He's collaborated with the Coen brothers on several films, including Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? He's also produced albums for many artists, including the Bodines, Elvis Costello, and Sarah Bareilles. And he's just released his first album in over a decade. It's called The Invisible Light, Acoustic Space. And it's not like any of his previous music. It's a fusion of trance, folk, tribal, and global. T-Bone explains the album's inspiration.
Well, The Invisible Light is from Choruses on the Rock by T.S. Eliot, which is an extraordinary beat poem, and one I aspire to. And it's the way he refers to divinity. But it also comes from this notion of that this record takes place in a very dark space, but we're generating a lot of life from within that dark space. And so if you can listen into it, you hear the mirth, you hear the humor in it, and you hear the love in it, and you hear the optimism of not ignoring the dark space we're in, but actually looking at it. Because the darkness, as the book says, the darkness runs from the light.
We dream of the people's dreams. Our brains are washed, but they're not clean. We dream of the people's dreams.
God rest my troubled soul.
And I'm thinking that the subtitle, Acoustic Space, comes from my fellow Canadian media visionary Marshall McLuhan, right?
That's true, yeah. McLuhan said in acoustic space, there's no center and there's no border. So everywhere you are is the center. And the thing about visual space is the space of the predator. You know, we look for the thing we want to eat, whereas acoustic space, audio space, is the space of the prey. So that if we're walking through the woods and a twig snaps behind us, we need to know that.
Yeah.
So we hear from every direction.
Yeah, and I would think that this idea of acoustic space is of special interest to you because you've said that everything you do, you try to do with a sense of place, right?
That is true, yeah. That's always been the most important thing to me. When I was a kid, there was a song called Begin the Begin. There was a beautiful record that my parents had of a song called Begin the Begin, and that song would come on and I would be transported to another land. And I thought the power of music to do that was well, extraordinary, and it's something I wanted to do the rest of my life, and I now have done the rest of my life.
Yeah, which is great. Yeah, we're the beneficiaries of that. You recently gave the keynote address at South by Southwest, and while you were doing that, you spoke out against the increasing power of the big tech surveillance capitalists like Facebook and Google, and you quoted from Shoshana Zuboff's book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. What exactly is surveillance capitalism?
Well, surveillance capitalism is a new form of capitalism. It's a new economic model where private data, private information is confiscated without the knowledge of the people from whom the data is being confiscated. And it's monetized without the understanding that the data is being monetized, and none of it is shared with the people from whom the data has been confiscated.
Right. They're basically these big companies like Facebook and Google are using us. We've become a product for them, a source of statistics and things.
Yeah, that's right. We have become the product.
Yeah. How does this idea of surveillance capitalism play out on the invisible light?
It plays into this whole notion of conditioned responses and this electronic programming. I'll tell you what you want to hear, then I'll do what I want to do. I'll tell you what you want to hear, then I'll do what I want to do. I'll play upon your darkest fear, I'll be a savant for you. We've gone through over a century of electronic programming as a race, and it's led to a whole plethora of different problems, some of which are neurological, like Alzheimer's and autism and Asperger's, those sorts of neurological disorders, but also a whole range of psychological disorders. But even beyond that, it's led to, you know, a technology that was sold to us as a way to connect us all has, in fact, disconnected us all from each other and driven us further and further into these screens. I mean, how often have you walked into a room full of people and seen them all staring at their hands, you know?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. This album marks a radical shift in the sound of your music. To my ears, it has this very Orwellian, kind of dystopian quality. You call the music on this album trip visualist music. What is trip visualist music? It's a great phrase.
Well, yeah, that's the phrase that came up while we were recording it, the idea that we were trip visualists as an art movement.
Yeah, that's
so
cool.
So we're starting this art, the trip visualist art movement.
And, great.
It has to do with, you know, we've been, a lot of this music grew out of the film scores we've been doing, especially the True Detective scores.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blending of that sort of electronic film score type approach with a very tribal, heavy rhythm vibe, you know.
Yeah, and Jay Belarus's drums are very prominent in the mix, and there's a real cinematic quality to the album.
Right, so that's the visualist part. It's in a sense a soundtrack or a score for a film that hasn't been made.
Are you planning on making it?
Yeah, I'm collaborating with different visual artists on a number of different fronts with this music, and there are several other pieces to come later. This is just the first edition.
Yeah, there are two more editions, right?
And maybe more after
that. Oh, great.
But we've already recorded two more editions.
Oh, excellent. Looking forward to those, and they'll be released, I think, 6 months apart?
That's the idea.
Yeah, looking forward to that, yeah. The second song on The Invisible Light is called A Man Without a Country.
I've always been a man without a country. I've always been a citizen of heaven. And now because the world is blue, I've only love to give to you. I've only love to give to you.
It ends with 2 minutes of very soft, very quiet ambient sound. I'm wondering, is this your tribute to John Cage, kind of a cover version of 4:33 in Cut Time, or a speed metal version?
Yeah, speed metal version,
yeah.
Of 4:33,
yeah.
Yes, exactly. No, you know, it's, I don't know what John Cage was up to with that. He certainly opened the door to this sort of thing, so In a way, I'm sure it is. It certainly comes after Cage. But it was the idea behind it was that with all of this electronic programming, we've become victims of a very arcane behavioral modification that has shrunk our attention spans to practically nothing, you know, to 3 seconds. I think I read recently that the average attention span is under 3 seconds.
Wow.
And pop music has pandered to that, as pop music so often has pandered to the worst instincts of the audience. And what we wanted to do with this was instead to expand our own attention spans. So how long could we allow ourselves to just sink into pure sound without knowing what it was or why it was or how it came to be there, just to be able to listen? Because that's what we need to do.
Yeah.
We are, in this time, we are prey.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And in order to survive, we're going to have to learn to listen.
Getting back to this idea of sense of place, what kind of place do you imagine the invisible light happening in?
Well, it happens in a place called Itopia in our cosmology. You know, Thomas More coined the word utopia from two Greek words, eutopia, which meant a good place, and outopia, which meant no place at all. And what he was saying in the book Utopia is, here's a good place that doesn't exist. And I believe now we live in another place like that, that is, we've called Itopia because of, I suppose, the internet, you know.
Yeah, is it kind of a, sorry to cut you off, T-Bone, is it called Itopia because as a kind of a critique of the digital narcissism that runs rampant in our culture?
Precisely. MySpace, iPhone, et cetera.
Yeah. You know,
an essential piece of art for everyone to view at the moment is the first episode of The Century of the Self by Adam Curtis. I think we've got it on our website now, but you can find it, and you can find it. It's on YouTube. It's on different places, but it's an extraordinary exposition on the 20th century and when the self became dominant, this idea of the self, and how the self has been taken over, has been co-opted by technicians.
Yeah. The album ends with an Itopia chant, which is very short. Can you tell me about the Itopia chant?
Well, the Itopia chant is,
we want you to know you can learn anything. We want you to know.
That's the whole Itopia chant.
And yeah.
That's where we are now. We're in this place where we're being told we have all this information. We have all the information in the world at our fingertips. But the information that technologists want us to know is being injected into our eyes and into our brains. And we don't really, you know, we have all the information, but we have no information. We don't have the crucial information that we need to survive.
Yeah, it's a message of hope. So I'm guessing then that you're optimistic that we can conquer surveillance capitalism?
I think we can. I think that can go away pretty quickly. In fact, we see how frequently it does go away. I mentioned MySpace a minute ago.
You know? That's long gone.
Yeah, and not only that, but they lost an extraordinary archive, apparently. You know.
Yeah.
And it's all ephemeral. It is. We have to remember it is artificial intelligence, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not actual intelligence. Like when a human being reads a book, he doesn't copy the book onto his brain and just have a copy of the book in his brain. He understands the book and he learns the book and he draws knowledge from it and he draws understanding from it, but he doesn't copy it. All a machine does is copy it onto its brain, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't understand it. It doesn't intuit anything about it. So there is a real difference between human learning and what they call machine learning.
Yeah, so what is it going to take? In your mind, what do you think it's going to take to conquer surveillance capitalism?
I think it's going to take knowledge, and that's what we're up to with this series, the Invisible Light series, is spreading knowledge, disseminating the things we've learned over the last... Really, I've been studying this phenomenon for 50 years, starting with McLuhan and Jacques Ellul in the early 1960s and Neil Postman. Certainly, there are a lot. This has been a long, ongoing study for me. And Ben Bagdikian was part of it, the media monopoly, the image Whatever Happened to the American Dream. There's a series of books. In fact, I'm going to turn my website into a pro-humanity Drudge Report, you know, to disseminate this knowledge. There's also a book I want to recommend to you and to all your listeners that I think is the most important book of the 21st century so far. It's The Road to Unfreedom. And he goes back into really the 800s and the history of all the different European empires and the way the empires crumble and the way they tried to become nation states and how all the nation states failed.
Yeah. You've worked with the guitarist Mark Rebo many times, and we had him on the show a few months back, and he talked about the difference between protest music and resistance music. I'm curious, do you see The Invisible Light as being protest music or resistance music or something else entirely?
I don't know what it is. It's to me, it's a repository of everything I've learned. It's a place for me to put what I've learned down. I don't want to put it in a book. I don't want to write a memoir. I don't want to, you know, that's not what I do. I'm not an author. So this is the place I'm going to put it down.
Yeah, and thank you for putting it down. It's such a great work. It's such a great work. You've collaborated with the Coen brothers, Joel and Ethan, on many of their films, including Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And Inside Llewyn Davis, which chronicles the life of a struggling folk singer. And you've said that Inside Llewyn Davis is the story of your life. How so?
Well, Springsteen, Bruce said it was the story of his life, except he had a happy ending. You know? But certainly, in the case of Bruce and me, there's this there's this figure that towers over all of us, you know, this Bob Dylan guy. But more than that, it's just the struggle of an artist to be able to tell the truth. Because the one thing an artist has to do is to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in this time when no one else can tell the truth.
Oh,
no,
yeah.
The media are hamstrung by advertising, and so is the church. And science has completely lost its way because of its doctrine of ethical neutrality, and because they have this doctrine of they can't make value judgments, they can't make any judgments, really. So the artists are what's left, and we're in a business that panders. The church panders to the congregation, the news people pander to the audience, and the artists have been pandering to the audience as well, telling them what they want to hear and succumbing to this idea of that people only have 3-second attention span, so we're going to give you something else every 3 seconds to think about.
T-Bone Burnett is a producer, musician, and songwriter. His album is called The Invisible Light, Acoustic Space. You can find out more about T-Bone on our website, wpr.org/beta.
I heard from, say, the people who were early into designing things like Twitter or Facebook, that one of the reasons why those companies took a long time to understand that harassment was something they were going to have to need to deal with was because they were mostly young guys, young white guys, running those companies, starting those companies.
Up next, journalist Clive Thompson on how coders are remaking our world. I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. These days, it may seem like it's a coder's world, and we're just living in it, which is true. Whether it's algorithms that curate our news feeds, revolutionary apps, or cars that drive themselves, our world is made out of code. And it's only a matter of time until radio shows and podcasts start creating themselves. I'll bet they already are. Journalist Clive Thompson is the author of Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. The book takes you inside the heads of coders.
The people who get drawn to coding and who find they really love it tend to have a couple of traits, I found, when I talked to, you know, I guess about 200 of them.
Wow.
So some of them, I think, are the ones you'd expect. Like, they're pretty good at being logical and systematic. They love, you know, solving puzzles by breaking them down into little steps. You know, they're and they're very precise people. Like they're you have to be when you're, when you're coding. If you put a semicolon in the wrong place, 10,000 lines of code can just stop working instantly. So they're incredibly meticulous people, and sometimes you know that even comes out when I'm talking to them or interviewing them or emailing with them. They're incredibly precise with the way they talk sometimes and the way they use language. So in some respects I think that's kind of the stuff that maybe people would expect. But I also found some kind of unexpected things, right? Like like they often are very they're very enthralled by and maybe even obsessed with efficiency and taking things that are slow or you know or involve a lot of repetition and scut work. They love getting in there and figuring out how to automate that, how to speed it up, how to torque it up. And it just brings them in like almost sort of a spiritual joy.
Yeah.
They feel appalled when they see something being done inefficiently, and they love the feeling of, hey, I wrote the code that sped this up.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. So so there's definitely character types, totally.
You think you can do our whole job in 2 days?
I know I can do it in 2 days. I pound Mellow Yellow, Oreos, and Adderall, and I don't sleep until I'm done.
So is it fair to say then that coding is less about making things and it's more about fixing things?
You know, actually, that's a great point. I really think it is. I think if you were to like just, you know, poll all the coders that are out there working today, how many of them are building, you know, kind of cool new apps or adding interesting new features to, you know, to what their software does? That's a tiny percentage. Most of them are just showing up at work and like, wow, something broke last night, or something stopped working, or someone tried to add a new feature and it broke everything. And they are just in there trying to figure out what went wrong.
Yeah, so is there a certain kind of mental state that coders tend to have?
One of the things that the mental state that coders really need to get into is what is that flow state that the MIT professor Michaeli Csikszentmihalyi talks about.
Yeah.
And that is the state of deep, deep immersion in the job at hand. Because, you know, whether you're writing code and trying to debug something that's not working, or whether you're one of these people that showed up at work and something's broken, you got to fix it, it requires you to sort of build this mental palace in your head, right? What's the flow of this piece of software? You know, it's supposed to do this, and then this is supposed to happen. And if that happens, that's supposed to happen. So it can take, you know, many minutes or even many hours of, like, looking at the code and stepping through it in your mind to be able to inhabit exactly what's going on. And it's only at that deep, deep, deep immersion that you can begin to really do the hard work. And once you're in there, you want to stay there. So I would hear coders tell me that, like, you know, they go to their job during the day, but because of all the meetings and people, you know, tapping them on the shoulder, they really can't get any of that deep dive work done. So they do little bits of work during the day, but the hardcore stuff happens at 8 o'clock at night. They get home and they get in that trance and they're there until 3 or 4 in the morning. And that's when the real work gets done.
Something is happening. When you left, I thought he was fried. Okay? Because his shoulders were all tight and he wouldn't answer to his name and his eyes went dead. But then he just got stronger. Richard has finished the scheduler and is almost ready to merge the serverless runtime. Look, look.
He implemented all those tasks by himself? I was supposed to take the whole team 4 days.
They have a need for intellectual immersion that, you know, almost reminds me of what you hear artists like novelists or painters talking about, where they get deep in that trance of creativity and they're just there for like 24 solid hours and they come out at the other end stumbling into the light.
Yeah, which makes me think, you mentioned that it's very similar to an artist's creative state. You often, throughout the book, you talk about the coding being similar to poetry. Can you explain
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. There's something very similar, I think, about the art and craft of writing good code and the art and craft of writing good poetry. Because in the case of poetry, one of the things that poetry often does very well is express an awful lot in a very short space.
Mm-hmm.
You get one or two lines and they're just absolutely perfect. And they ring like a bell, but they open up all these things inside your mind. And so there's a compression to good poetry that is remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very similar in code, where, you know, you could write the really complicated, you know, ugly way to do this. But if you're like a really good coder or an attentive one, you try and shrink it. You try and do it in fewer lines so that it's easier to glance at and understand what's really going on. So there's this elegance and economy and parsimonious to good coding that is really a delight and joy to a lot of coders.
Mm-hmm. There's this compression and using the fewest words possible. Like Raymond Carver probably would have been a good coder.
Yeah, yeah. Or T.S. Eliot. Yeah, or, yeah. You know, actually, you know who would have been great? Emily Dickinson. Okay. So you read, okay. She'll have like, you know, like 5 or 6 lines, and it's just, oh my, how did you do that? Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. I mean, yeah, that's just so fantastic,
yeah. Yeah,
right?
It is.
I am done! Look at this! Woo! Coat sprint over! Okay.
That was an out of body experience. It was like God was coding through me.
If so much of coding is looking for mistakes, a coder must experience this really euphoric high when he or she writes successful code or fixes a bug. Is that the case?
Oh my God, absolutely. And it's funny. So I did a little bit of coding when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, back in those like, you know, days when you had computers you plugged into a TV.
Yeah.
And you did BASIC.
Right.
But I didn't really do much throughout my 20s and 30s, you know. And in my 40s, I decided, okay, I'm interested in writing this book, so let me take some of the new programming languages and learn a little bit of them, JavaScript, Python. And so I started doing this stuff and teaching myself online. And I immediately discovered this phenomena of, wow, I'm just grinding away and this stuff is not working. Mm. But the moment I got it to work, you know, my wife sort of got used to hearing me, you know, from across the room, or maybe I was upstairs, just she'd hear this whoop of joy because, you know, I'd finally figured it out. And I'll tell you, I don't think I feel that jolt of pleasure in any of my professional work as a writer. Nothing really compares, you know? And that's interesting,
yeah,
right?
It's very interesting. You say, you write in the book, you say you discovered that it was much more satisfying to program than to write. Why?
I think the reason why I found it more fun and rewarding to program than to write is because writing is an act of persuasion. Mm-hmm. I can't really tell you whether or not my book or my article is objectively good or whether it's working, right? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that's in the eye of the beholder. I have to convince the audience that I've made a good argument, that I've done good research. So it's up to them. But with coding, you know, when I write a little piece of code and I'm trying to accomplish a task and it's finally working, there's a binary sort of pass-fail nature to that. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't come to me and tell me that code isn't working. It is. It is a machine. It is doing what I wanted it to do. So there's this sense of crisp clarity in the wins of coding that isn't really there in the wins of writing, you know? Like, I mean, and I just sort of enjoyed the clarity of those wins.
But there's no chance that you would ever give up writing and take up coding full time, is there?
I don't think so. I think I like what I do too much. But here's what I have discovered about myself, and I think this carries some lessons for the rest of society, which is that I've found that knowing a little bit of coding transforms me into being a much more effective journalist, because I now write little pieces of code to help me with various parts of my journalism, you know? I can use them to sort of analyze text, or I can take something repetitive I'm doing and speed it up or make it routine so I don't have to think about it anymore. And to me, this is really interesting because there's been this movement of people saying that, you know, everyone should learn to code, or, you know, we should teach coding mandatorily at the high school level. I think sometimes there's this unrealistic idea that the average person, you know, in middle life could change their life by becoming a coder and getting a job in Silicon Valley and writing software. I think that can happen. I know it's happened. But honestly, what's more valuable in learning to code is to be able to take what you're already doing for a living and become better at it.
Mm, yeah, good advice. Speaking of this idea of learning to code, recently the phrase learn to code started showing up on Twitter to mock journalists who were being laid off from their jobs. So I'm curious to know what you as a journalist and a sometime coder think about this learn to code
theme. Sure. Well, I followed that. And what happened was that a bunch of journalists got laid off.
Yeah.
And so some of the folks in sort of the alt-right, you know, sort of troll swamps decided that they would mock these journalists by saying, hey, laid off journalists, just learn to code. And so they took something that, you know, was otherwise a perfectly inoffensive and even, you know, nice sort of piece of advice, and they were just using it to sort of, like, mock what they perceived to be the uselessness of journalists. It was, shall we say, not a good faith argument, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I definitely think, you know, you can make a good faith argument. You can say to people, this is a fun and entertaining and potentially valuable thing to learn a little bit of. And as it happens, I actually think a lot of journalists would be quite good at it. But, you know, that only obtains if you're coming at it from a good faith point of view.
She was head of engineering at Earcast?
She was engineering at Earcast. She built that whole system on her own.
You know what else excites me here? There's a distinct overrepresentation of men in this company. Look around. I think it would behoove us to prioritize hiring a woman.
When coding first became a job in the 1950s and 60s, women were considered naturals. In fact, they were often pioneers. But now there aren't nearly as many women, percentage-wise, working in coding. What happened?
Well, what happened is that coding drifted away from being, you know, an open door that rewarded merit. In the early days, no one knew how to code, you know, the 50s mm-hmm. and 60s. So if you were a university or company that had a computer and you needed coders, you would hire anyone who was just kind of good at solving puzzles or logic and then train them on the job. And that meant it was a very open door, and a lot of women who are, you know, perfectly good at puzzle solving and logic walked in. But over the next few decades, what started happening is that software became much more critical and important and financially significant for companies. And they started deciding, okay, we need to hire coders who could move upwards in management, who could become vice presidents and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And in the very sexist 70s, there was no way they were going to put a woman in charge of men. So at the same time as this industry is becoming very crucial, women are getting pushed out, even women with a lot of experience, because of the sexism and even the policies and laws of the time. So, you know, it's been like a 20, 30-year journey in that regard, and finally there's some attention being paid to it, and there's definitely way more women flowing in to study computer science right now. It's in the last 5 years, it's been a big uptick. What remains to be seen is whether or not the industry itself can evolve to accommodate all the women who are graduating and want to move into those significant roles.
Yeah. There are also fewer Black and Latino coders, right?
Very few, yeah. I mean, the numbers are in the single digits in most places. And at very elite companies, you know, it can be as low as 1% or 2%. And that is for some of the same reasons, which is to say, you know, they simply had far fewer opportunities. You know,
yeah.
If you look at everything ranging from the digital divide, like who's got broadband and who doesn't,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, makes it a lot harder to
oh,
learn
yeah.
programming if you don't have ready access to the internet, because that's where it's at, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I was just looking at the statistics. So 2018, you know, something like 72% of white families had broadband at home in America. And for Hispanics, it was down at like 53%.
Wow.
And for African Americans, it was like 62%. So that you see these really big deltas, and they correlate directly with socioeconomic status. So you sort of see just that opportunity to learn at home or to learn in a school. You know, you're at a school. Schools in the well-off neighborhoods, they have computer science. Schools in the poor districts, they don't.
Yeah.
So, you know, these things all, you know, work to sort of create these choke points that have prevented a lot of people of color from getting into coding.
Yeah. What do you think that we as a society lose when we have so few women and people of color working as coders?
Well, on the one hand, just as a matter of economic opportunity, you know, no society should stand for that type of thing, particularly
yeah.
a society like the United States that has historically prided itself on being more open, you know, like, you know, whoever you are, wherever you come from, you're supposed to be able to make it here, right?
Yeah.
But there's also a level at which you don't get software designed as well when a small, you know, monolithic or monoculture of people are creating it. You know, I heard from, say, the people who were early into designing things like Twitter or Facebook, that one of the reasons why those companies, you know, took a long time to understand that, you know, harassment, you know, or crazy white supremacy was something they were going to have to need to deal with, was because they were mostly young guys, young white guys running those companies, starting those companies. And it was just, you know, it's just not in their experience. They don't really deal with a lot of systematic abuse heaped on them because of their identity, the way that women might online, or African Americans might online, or Hispanics might online. So they were simply just less attuned to that as a design element, something that they should have thought about when they were designing how the software works, how to curtail abuse. If you're designing software for the broad mass of the public and the world, you really want to have people involved in creating it and coding it and designing it who understand all those different use cases. Yeah. That's why it's better to have a slightly more diverse team building software for the masses.
Clive Thompson is the author of Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. You can find out more about Clive at wpr.org/beta. We've run out of code for this edition of Beta. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
You don't sell the steak, you sell the sizzle.
Our technical and music director is Steve Gotcher.
Well, I am just a T-bone kind of guy.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I'll tell you what's insane. The price that I could get you on a new desktop computer.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
You stole my Jesus fish, didn't you?